An interview with Richard
Solo, formerly of the chemistry department, and now responsible for various student activities.
That is the letter that went out to some members of the faculty.
Uh-huh.
And with questions. The purpose is to get recollections of the early days, let's say up to 71.
Okay.
Do that before people die off.
And forget, or both.
Yes.
Certainly death will shorten one's memory.
And I wrote that letter for Jerry, and he just sent it out.
Right.
The idea had been originally to have a history of the university. I think for the first 25 years, and then they realized that that had gotten by them. And then the history for 25 years on this campus didn't seem to be quite right, and a 30-year history didn't seem to be quite right. And they had looked at one or two other people. This is, I think, Homer Neal started. And found that there were biases, admitted biases, one way or another, towards John Toll and others. And so Jerry Schubel just pulled back. And originally I had learned about this project, the project of writing history, and offered to be helpful for the 3 years where I was acting. And then Schubel called me in one time and told me what he had run into about trying to get somebody to do the history. And I had incidentally checked to see if Judge Sullivan, who had been chairman of our council, had, and who had passed on, had left any records. And I got back a letter from his second wife that everything in his home had been thrown out, and she had checked with his secretary at the courthouse, and there were no records left there that related to Stony Brook. So I sent that letter to Jerry and also pointed out what was pointed out in there, that the three governors were dead, Tom Hamilton was dead, our dean, Stan Ross, was dead. People were passing off. And
let's hope there's not a cause and effect between the words.
No, no, this all happened prior. So he asked me if I would do the oral history, collect information, which should be helpful in interpreting what written records we have. Now, as far as you're concerned, I have asked questions about student life, the situation in the dormitories, the quality of the student body, student-faculty relations, that sort of thing. And I haven't gotten a great deal yet. Tilly is coming over.
Ah, wonderful. You did trace him.
Yes, I did.
Did Don Bybee help in that, or will you get an independent route?
I think, I don't know where I got, I think Max Mobley had,
Max,
had,
yeah.
had the telephone number.
Yes, he...
But anyway, he's coming
that
over.
That should be wonderful.
Yes. Okay, and Don, I'm going to see Don Bybee, too.
Good.
So,
both of them at that time, although this is perhaps slightly off the point, were involved in the admissions office, and therefore in a relatively small institution.
Yes.
Were central to the development of an understanding of the student body. Indeed, Dave Tilley was the dean of students.
Yes.
Until difficulties of an unimaginable sort came along. And I am somewhat aware of that, as is true of most of us. None of us understood anyone else's life very well, and our own sometimes not as well as we should have. But Dave, well, we may get to that later on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me suggest then that we start with the question so that there
sure.
is some structure.
Sure. Okay. We will chat. probably be easier for both of us.
Right.
According to the list of questions, it starts with name, department, rank, or position.
That's right.
I can give you a number of them. When I first came here, I was an assistant professor in chemistry.
Right.
And was that until about 1968, 67, 68. Came in 62.
Right. You came in 62.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. The first year that Stony Brook was physically at Stony Brook.
Right. That's when I
was
came
the first
too.
Year I was here.
Yeah.
And I remember some few moments that we had. I then found that I wasn't productive enough in the traditional academic sense to continue the department, but nevertheless had enjoyed myself a great deal at Stony Brook and determined to try an alternative academic and non-academic position. In the transition summer, I was involved in something called the Change Clinic around 1967, 68. A Change Clinic that Alexander Pond and other people put together to develop mechanisms that involve students who would be sophisticated in their efforts to make changes, both conceptual and practical changes, in the institution. This is now the mid-60s, late mid-60s, a very interesting time. We'll get back to that.
Right.
Then, the following September, I was an associate director of residential counseling.
Did you work with...
Scott Rickard.
Scott Rickard.
Well, who was the first?
Larry DeBoer, was he involved?
No, Larry at that time was probably involved in the beginnings of the college plan. We'll get to that in a minute. The residential college plan.
All right.
There was a very complicated and unsatisfying period for a few months at that time that led to the removal of the vice president for student affairs. It wasn't Trask. Maybe it was Trask. I'll have to think about who
Trask
it was.
Trask was chairman of the history department.
No, but there was someone, might have been Trask, who was a VPSA, vice president for student affairs, for all of 2 to 3 months.
Oh, I see.
And better check that out.
Yeah.
And Scott Rickard, who was the director of the residential counseling program, who was an unknown, became the vice president for student affairs, probably in part because of his talent and in part because no one knew who he was. These were very difficult times. And then I became the director of the residential counseling program. Strange for me to be in that position, but none of the other people could agree on each other, and it's one of those least enemy type things.
I see.
We had a very active program, and were responsible for the counseling aspects of people known as residential assistants. My office was, in fact, in one of the dormitories. About 2 or 3 years later, I also became involved in the residential college program. The tensions between many of the faculty, the president, and students, and all of that wrapped in one interesting picture, led to a change of Larry DeBoer's position, among other things. I became director of the residential college program for about 2 years, and it'd be safe to say I had very few friends in that position. Some thought I was directly responsible for the destruction of the program, others thought I had saved it for a few years. Probably neither of those exaggerations are the truth, but again, we may get back to that. Because the residential college program was one of the most interesting early experiments in alternative education at Stony Brook. After that, I became more directly involved in counseling and the orientation program, and now I'm primarily responsible for the orientation program of new students, with a number of other responsibilities, but the primary one is the orientation program.
What's the size of a freshman class?
Our current size of freshman class is a little under 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
And there is fairly good data since I looked at it recently. I was trying to answer a question that seems to be asked of people who are around long enough these days. How have things changed?
Yeah. So Ray Manusco has a lot of data.
Not many people have really looked at that stuff, but I looked at 1966 data from something called the American Council on Education Student Information Survey. 1966, 77 and 1986, data that dealt with decade, more or less decade changes, in which one can, with some care and some reservations, talk about the academic profiles, social profiles of the high school students that became our students in Stony Brook. And it would be safe to say, at least on the basis of that kind of data, that our student body in the mid-late 60s, 66 is one data point, were spectacularly more academically successful in high school than the current group, which is successful.
The current group is
1986, 87, is successful in the sense that they're in high school, because that's what the American Council on Education would measure. It examines attitudes and records of people who are entering the freshman class. So what it portrays is more what the high school senior realities were than what our Stony Brook students were like. But one assumes that people don't change as dramatically as some would like. So we knew about their attitudes, some of their political attitudes, some of their academic interests, their place in their high school class, and the data at the time could relate those attitudes to the national norms.
One thing I don't think shows up, whether they're housebroken or not.
Well, I think we know the answer to that. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the 60s and 70s. I think it would be fair to say that the degree of destructiveness of the students in the late 60s had no SUNY parallel. There may have been some, in terms of the degree to which this campus was reduced in its physical attributes, whether that's the furniture and the lounges, whether that's the student rooms, and whether it's, in fact, many of the public spaces as well. There have been hardly, I can't think of any campus I've visited that had as many deep and lasting scars on it from the activities of the students during the late 60s as has Stony Brook.
Why?
Well,
why?
I can't speak comparatively about the effectiveness of the management of the institutions other than Stony Brook. And so I can't say that we were better or worse. But I think there was a blend. I think there were two reasons that I can think of, and I bet I could think of 30 more if I thought more about it. I think first, in the life of the young administration of Stony Brook, in the late 60s, after you came along, most of the administration was quite young in terms of higher education. People in their probably 40s and 50s. And probably had never, and I don't think very many people in this country had ever experienced in higher education, the kinds of pressures that the Vietnam War, the sexual revolution, the drug revolution would present. And therefore there was nothing to fall back on, and therefore one had to imagine effective responses. Two, I think that Stony Brook looked like a place for the Hawthorne effect to appear effective. And let me explain what I mean by that. That we attracted, because we were new and because we were exciting, even if some of that perhaps was an exaggeration, but not by much, we attracted some of the more experimental students. Some of the more likely malcontents, but bright malcontents, very effective leaders, not always effective in the sense of their cause, but effective in the sense of rallying people. We had almost no traditions. We were in 1966, 67, 68. We were at Stony Brook for all of 4, 5, 6 years. We had very little in the way of traditions we could draw from that came from Oyster Bay. So in reality, we had very little to stop and break any excessive behavior. We had a very strong attitude among some of the faculty who were quite young, and some of the students who were obviously quite young, a certain degree of hostility to authority, not just the students, but also the faculty, that could express itself locally. We could become our own enemy. We could use the administration to some extent, and when I say we, I'm on both sides of all of this in the sense you might say I'm a student, I'm a faculty member, I'm an administrator. So the we I'm speaking of at Stony Brook, But I'll go on in a moment, because I did some strange things that time. Not exciting, don't get nervous. But it became clear that the institution was its own enemy for some of the faculty and some of the students. So there was a willingness to allow a good deal of self-destructive behavior to go on. There was confusion about what effective responses would look like to reduce the amount of drug experimentation, sexual experimentation, and political experimentation in a time when perhaps to some extent we had modest terrorism in our midst, if you want to really think about it in a more modern term. I don't think anyone ever described the students and some of the faculty as terrorists.
No.
But it would be easier to see some of the attitudes in those terms, perhaps, than we did at that time. The campus became almost unmanageable in terms of day-to-day behavior for about 2 to 3 years, from roughly 66, 67 to about 70, 71, in that region, give or take a year. What do I mean? I mean by that there were times when we couldn't offer final exams because the bomb threats were so frequent. There were times when the sit-ins would last days and more days and stop and start again. And indeed, some of this referred to strange behavior on my part was that I was neither a friend or an enemy of very many people, and not an enemy. And therefore, during many of the sit-ins, I would spend many of my days and nights in the library while the building was being controlled by the students. I was neither viewed as a friend or an enemy, and I thought I might be more useful to calm some of the people down by being inside.
Who were the people? Students?
Primarily students. Our students. A few outside influential people who had come either from the city or some party. Probably their influence was exaggerated. There was even Allen Ginsberg would be sitting with some students and some faculty trying to write up some set of demands or manifesto.
Right?
Oh yeah, I was part of that. Much of what it appeared to be on the inside of the buildings involved what were commonly called human activities. People had to eat, people had to sleep, people had to try to reason their way, and I use the word reason, their way through the next step in a struggle. I'm sure, because I also saw part of that, that the administration was trying to provide as much order and as much progress towards the educational mission of the institution as it could. These groups did not speak well with one another, because as 66 became 67 became 68, the methodology became more one of legalism, and resorting, as it probably had to the use of legal force, ejection of people from buildings. If for no other reason, the frustration of trying to run a university in this chaos was just unacceptable. But it would be a mistake to assume that the group of students, because I was a part of them physically, not a part of them organizationally, the students and some faculty and some outside people were crazy people. They were largely purposeful and used the disruption of the campus is a way to force their issues.
How many?
And there was some destruction as well.
How many other Mitch Cohens did you have?
Well, I think it's only one Mitch Cohen, since he's still with us. I don't know of anyone else who has survived. I think it would be fair to say at that time that there were dozens of fairly articulate, purposeful, and occasionally confused, and occasionally very confused students, and maybe Mitch was part of that, we can debate that. But Mitch had some very strong political leanings and some very strong directions that were not shared by everybody. But if we look at Mitch Cohen as an organizer, and we look at him as a student of those times, and we look at him as someone who tried to accomplish something no matter how unsuccessfully, he was by no means alone or the single leader. The general leadership quality of a large number is too strong, of perhaps dozens of students, compared to the quality of the student leadership that expresses student leadership in 1986-7. Quality in 1966-67 was far greater. These people were academically far more successful than 60s in their high school classes. But all of this was new territory. I mean, it would be a mistake to assume these people had come to Stony Brook in 1966 to destroy the institution. But the response, we'll need to talk a little bit about the dorms in a moment, the response to Vietnam the response to political chaos and vacuum, credibility of a leadership in the eyes of many of these students, the credibility had become so low that I think people were willing to experiment with political alternatives that were, I think, in the long run viewed as either foolish, naive, or destructive. But the values that people were seeking to explore, with some serious exceptions, were not as crazy as one might assume. Values that express themselves in religious experimentation as well. There's a good deal of attempts to examine the Eastern methodology, human developmental groups.
What values can you pick out of the
ones the students were looking for?
Yeah. What do you think they were looking
for? I don't think there was ever a consistent set. I think that some of the values were as far in one direction to destroy authority for its own sake, chaos. Some of the values could be expressed as political responsibility as viewed by the people who stated it. That doesn't mean everyone would agree, but there was a strong hostility to the Washington leadership of the time that developed and deepened to the war in Vietnam, to the possibility of being conscripted. So that the value there, in some case, might be self-preservation. The strong value, I think, involved the right of the individual to do anything the individual wished to do with as little external influence as possible, parental, institutional, organizational. The value could almost be the creation of a personal order that brooked no input from the outside. That would be childish, I mean, if you want to think, that's an early attitude of a child that wishes to do anything for the sake of doing it. But it was a value that people considered important, very much like childlike values. There were values, I think, that had to do with mystical and spiritual matters, to find the source of power. Many of the students I spoke with were involved in Eastern religion groups. There were ashrams in the nearby neighborhood that I had visited a few. It wasn't profoundly my style to express myself in that form, but students would invite me and I'd go along to see what it was that they were interested in. There were some faculty who became very much involved in Eastern ways that probably now they could barely remember if they
were
impressed.
Were they from the arts or the social sciences?
Oh, no. I can think of one who's a physicist that I spent some time with. I would say that there wasn't as clearly a particular type of person, at least that I understood as a type of person or a particular academic background. I think it was pretty much, may not have been even, but there certainly wasn't a non-science or a science preference that I could pick. I think there were values of people that were literally treating the value of the freedom to explore as a value in and of itself. And unfortunately, that took on every imaginable form, political and drugs and sexual and family. And I met some interesting people on that as well, any of those areas, all of those areas. The institution, as a quick resident, you'll ask another question in a moment, but I want to point out it was at this time, around 1967 or 8, that the institution decided to experiment in coeducational dormitories. And that I think it was 68, but not far from that. And the experiment was thought to be initially an experiment where some dorms would be co-ed and others not. And although that was true, there were many more that immediately adopted coeducational structures than had been originally the plan. There were only two or three or four, perhaps at most, of our maybe 15 or so dorms at that time that were of a single sex. And they quickly disappeared within probably 3 or 4 years after that. You were going to ask something, huh?
No, I don't think so. I'm interested in the reaction of both faculty and administration to the 60s and to this period of free expression.
Well, or relatively free expression and experimentation. I think the answer is that you won't find, again, two people who would agree. There were significant faculty support for some aspects of the experimentation and exploration and chaos. It would be a mistake to assume one or two. it probably one could, if one had intuitively put a percent on it, I would not surprise me that somewhere between 15, 20, maybe 30% of the faculty were sympathetic. Some of those were deeply involved in helping the students and themselves express their concerns for the issues that they viewed important. Many of them were related to the war, anti-war issues. And clearly some of them represented a desire to create alternative universities within Stony Brook. In some ways, that was one of the unwritten, I think, agendas of the residential college program. We may come back to that.
All right.
But it would be fair to say that a significant component of the faculty were sympathetic. Of the administration, it would be fair to say a smaller but by no means negligible fraction of the administration. I'm thinking of one or two people in the president's office. I'm thinking of a couple of people in student affairs. Some people in residence life, although then it was probably called housing.
Was Ackley still there? Sheldon Ackley?
Sheldon Ackley was definitely there through most of this period.
Yeah.
He would be viewed as not sympathetic in his role as assistant to the president. He may have, in his concerns with the ACLU, have had some personal feelings about it, but in the few discussions I had with him, my recollection is that he had a very simple loyalty to the objectives of the president's office, which would be largely to run a responsible organization, and he drew some of the ire of the freedom-loving group. We can laugh about that, but anyway. But before him, I'm trying to think, John Burness came in short after that. John's up, at Cornell now, and would be an interesting other person. I don't know if he's on your list, but he's around.
He should be.
At Cornell.
He should be.
And John was clearly a person trying to guide, when he could, the president, who, we need to say a word or two about John Toll, but anyway, try to guide the president into more novel approaches to disengaging himself and sometimes the institution from confrontation. One of the things early on in John Toll's attempts to deal with this was that he was willing to take unto himself the role of being the focus of negotiations and of the embattled negotiations at that. And it did not disturb John Toll at all to deal with the morass of the hostilities that were part of that circumstance.
He had a certain amount of personal courage.
He had great courage. I don't think anyone would deny that. The trouble with that is that he not only saw it as probably what he should do, but often saw it as his sole responsibility in terms of who else could be in that position, meaning that he would put himself on the line, the public line, quickly and easily, and not realize that his rational style of problem solving tended quite often to raise the level of the confrontation. He was not an effective negotiator in this particular domain of confrontation. He understood what he wanted. He would not alter his position in any dramatic way that anyone could detect with a group of people who were probably as adamant about what they wished as he. Now again, this was new territory. John Toll, Dick Sola, Carl Hartzell, and all the people on your list were not educated in the methods of what was required of us in the 60s. So it depended upon learning quickly from one's experience. I recall that one of the more significant negotiating breakthroughs was to permit other people, other than the president himself, to take a step in the direction of trying to negotiate, or at least broaden the range of negotiation, including Alec Pond, including John Burness, including some faculty.
You want to mention any of the faculty? Max Dresden was...
Well, he's one of... well, go ahead.
Well, I was just asked you. You said including some of the faculty.
Yes.
Do you want to enumerate?
Well, I would put... I'm trying to think. Norman Goodman would be in there. And I occasionally found myself agreeing with Norman, and he more surprisingly with me. We spent time quite often trying to help students out of buildings before they might be arrested. Norman was, by and large, trying to provide some rational networks even if he was no one's greatest ally, he was at a, he attempted to bring reason into this. Max in Senate's, Senate meetings and otherwise, was clearly a person of integrity and credibility. I'm not sure, I have to really go through a list, even your list here. Surprisingly, some people who were clearly working with the president, I think John Burness in his way as an administrator, tried to find routes that would be more productive than simple confrontation.
How about Dave Tilley?
Dave was almost out of the picture. Dave was sacrificed, and maybe that's my word, on the drug issue. Dave Tilley was a powerful, demanding, thoughtful, I thought excellent vice president for student affairs or dean of students. He was given the impossible task of trying to also control student behavior because he was titled, you know what I mean, if anyone had to be called responsible for the student behavior, he had to be. And now we would look at such a notion of responsibility perhaps differently than we would then when we were still coming out of traditional norms when a dean of students, in effect, would be held responsible for the student's behavior in loco parentis. He was trapped in terms of drugs being planted on him, so as a few other people, not on him personally, but in his office. He ultimately, along with a number of other faculty, were...
Who did the planting?
Well, with some students. He was also the enemy of some students.
I see.
He was held accountable for the students' activities, and we had a major legal investigation. I went to the trials in New York City in Vesey Street or something. I can't recall the exact name of the trials, but a number of people were indicted, a number of sealed indictments were unsealed, a number of people on the faculty as well as the staff were, at that time, held accountable for the behavior in the institution. I can think of a few names at that time, even now, and it was within 1 or 2 years after those investigations that Dave Tilley was removed and other people in the student affairs office were asked to change or leave or whatever their roles. And probably it made sense to a lot of the people at the time that there could be someone accountable for the behavior of the students. I don't think now, in retrospect, that makes any sense at all. At the time, it may have. And I felt that Dave Tilley was trying to discover, and for him it meant rationally discover, the construction of a new form of a dean of students to deal with these new behaviors at a time when no one understood this very well. And I think he probably didn't satisfy anybody. I think his own staff was not understanding. I think that the students would clearly view him as the enemy, because he was at least more or less accountable. I think the administration must have felt betrayed by his inability to do more. And while he was probably trying to explain all sides to all sides at one time or another, my guess is he must have made no sense to anybody. I went to a number of meetings with him, and we had a number of conversations. Despite the fact that to this day I have a very high regard for him, I think he was an impossible person at an impossible time. He was too demanding in terms of the profession of being a student administrator. And that meant the nature of research and thoughtful readings and deliberations and professional commitments and so forth to one's organization on the one hand, and a profound involvement with the student environment on the other, in a world in which no one had any good answers. For whatever it's worth, I had a very high regard for his attempts to deal with what he had to deal with. He became an expert shortly after that in drug education. You know, his response was, you know, having, I don't know if he put it this way, but I would, having been badly burned by a particular technical issue, he would damn well be a master of it. And he has been in a number of different jobs since then, but frankly, I haven't kept close tabs.
Yeah.
And a progression. Vice presidents followed him, most of whom had very little luck. I'll give you an example. Scott Rickert came in, I think it was Dave Trask, who was in this vice president
right.
position for 3 months.
Yeah.
He was obligated, Trask, I think, to, can't recall the exact detail, but he was asked to do something. And it turned out that he was in some ways, I think, himself betrayed in portraying some particular situation. It might have been a drug policy, it might have been a presidential policy, it might have been a housing policy. I don't remember the details. But it became fairly clear that he became a non-credible person. He may have been set up unintentionally and discovered in some difficult, and I mean difficult situation. These were not good times. Interesting times for sure, but good times. He only lasted a few months. He probably would have continued if he could have, but my guess is he had a lot of alternatives to choose from. He said, this is madness, why should I do this? I think it was only about a month and a half, maybe 2 months. Scott Rigger came in, and we were dealing with such issues as whether to turn the RAs into student informers. The RA would be a residential assistant working in the dorms. And I was at one of the most horrific meetings that I learned a great deal from, it, in which the president, who wanted to be his own man, was explaining to a group of about ballpark 200 students who were RAs that they would have the responsibility to turn in any other students for drug abuse. And it was one of the most, I was in charge of that meeting, and I was absolutely, without any clear idea of what to do. It was new for me. I wanted to stop what was happening, whether I could have or not, is debatable, but here's the president. You know, it was very hard to sort of step in and say, look, let me take charge of this thing when the president is literally being roasted by some uncontrollable students who, by virtue of their position as RAs, are in a sense university employees, who at the same time are also, in some cases, part of the quotation marks, freedom-loving group. So I had a tape of this thing. I may still have a tape of this meeting. I don't know why I taped it, but I did. And it was horrible. And I was saying, you know, should I? You know, it was one of those things. I think if I were a couple of years older or whatever, I would have just insisted that I take over the meeting. And I'm not saying it would have done any good. But I felt, and then I walked back with the president. Probably, if he were a different person, would have just fired me on the spot for not either having more respect shown by the students, as if I could have done that, or done something about it. I mean, after all, it was a group that I had some small responsibility for. We talked about that, and I realized that I was not being very helpful to the president in trying to explain to him what I thought was happening in the minds of the students at that time. Nor was I very helpful with the students in terms of trying to help them understand the dilemma of the president, for different reasons why I was not very effective at that time. But it was an illustration of the president's willingness to take an incredibly unpopular position and present it himself, and ask for no help, and no one's opinion. In my case, I could say no one. He may have consulted with other people, but my guess is that his consultations were often either taken or not taken on the basis of whether they agreed with what he expected and wanted.
I knew relatively little about what was going on, but in my own memory, there's very little of that. I don't know how I would have reacted if I had been in his shoes. I would have probably been inclined to take a confrontational approach, although
the question is how.
Yeah.
See, everyone, can't be any question that it had to be confrontational. One couldn't agree with the students, and neither could I. I had long discussions with many students about what I saw as their self-destructive behavior, and whether I won or lost, or whether the students won or lost, is, you know, sometimes you're never too sure. I met some of those students 10, 20, 30 years later. Well, 30 years, no. 10, 20 years later. Confrontation had to be there. The question was whether anyone could learn quickly enough how to be more rather than less effective. There was no way to simply win.
Yeah.
And the president chose very dramatic confrontational methods. He agreed or disagreed. I mean, it wasn't a question of negotiating. And negotiation, even now, I'm not sure that there's a way that one could describe how you would have done it, even with the hindsight of almost 20 years or more. But confrontation certainly had to be understood. We had no trust to fall back on. We didn't have people who had been in the system for 20 to 30 years.
Yeah.
We didn't have what one might call the great statesman that some institutions would have had, who might have been able to at least tone it down. Everyone in 66 and 67 and 68 and for another year or two after that were all new to the business.
Right.
And it's Stony Brook business. I'm not talking about maybe some other places. We also, I mean, we must remember, as you would know better than most, 61 involved a presidential shift. There was a major confrontation that was fomented and developed at Oyster Bay vis-a-vis the so-called Chicago group and other people, and I wasn't there, but I've heard a few things. Yeah. One has to assume the faculty learned how to be reasonably hostile. You inherited that faculty. Mm-hmm. The people who are here now have no idea how much internal faculty dissension there was. So given that kind of young, energetic, opinionated, and not bad opinion, people had principles of what their education, but arguments. Throw in the late 60s, middling late 60s, in terms of the students and the presidential problems at the United States and the war and this and on and on and on. It isn't hard to understand how we at Stony Brook had much less of a handle, and more importantly, credible stabilizing resources to draw on. And in many ways, the president must have felt isolated. Toll must have felt pretty much isolated from the tools that maybe other institutions would have been able to call on, such as, well, you know, such as people who had been distinguished and accepted by the students.
Yeah.
So neither the faculty was all that stable, nor certainly the student body in certain parts. I think Toll made the decision that he would continue business as usual as much as he possibly could. And he did. I think at a very high price.
He was under pressure from Albany.
Absolutely.
And the community.
And we are, that's a good point too. We're out in the community which would have viewed, I remember an attempt on the part of John Toll just about this time to go off campus to develop, I think it was with Submergent, who was a local developer, some space that's at the corner of Nickel and 25A,
right,
on the eastern side. And he went to a number of local, I don't know if the chambers of commerce or at that time maybe they were
civic
organizations of one sort or another, and he presented his slides and his developmental plans. Beautiful stuff, well thought out. He was roasted. The local people couldn't imagine anything worse happening to them than the development of a significant university, and even worse than that, the development of some, actually, again, by any current standards, attractive dorms that could have been used for a conference center. Brilliant idea, not complicated, but brilliant, right, and all the rest. But the attitude of the local community, which obviously fed through the council and on up to Albany and so forth, must have put the president in an awful position to try to make significant progress in the areas he could have and should have, but couldn't, in fact.
Ward Melville had a set of plans drawn up by one of his architects for what was called cluster housing. And it looked to me as though it would have improved the south side of 25A no end. But
well, we had some cluster plan. That was pretty much what Submergent had in mind. And others, and I'm not sure about Hawley development, but I saw these plans. My point to some extent is that you were right, the local communities and Albany and other places were putting a great deal of pressure on this institution. The president must have felt that everyone wanted something else and certainly nothing that was possible. So he had to ultimately, I guess, fight his own battles. He must have had a lot of enemies and a lot of friends, but more enemies, my guess, in his attempts to not deviate from the academic development of the institution, which meant what? You remember in the 60s, certainly throughout the 60s, this was a largely a construction zone. And
we were keeping school right in the middle of a construction
site.
That's
right. We were running a university as the university was physically coming into its being. And again, a lot of people can't understand that, which meant that the amenities often were only in name. And that, as you know, for us, the greatest achievement in the late 60s, early 70s was that it wasn't mud everywhere.
Yeah.
It was, if you didn't have to walk through the mud, because finally the buildings that you had to deal with were completed, and the walkways were completed, never mind grass, flowers, trees, just simply that you didn't have to walk through the mud. And thank God for winter, because it froze everything, but there was always a thaw that caught you twice. In any case, the 60s also were presenting the students, we'll get back to your first question again in a moment, with these rather difficult, not very difficult, but rather difficult environmental issues, which fed all of the frustrations that the people had in other dimensions. So the dorms, in part, took a beating because they were typically occupied between, well, it's interesting, 6 months too late and 6 months too early. They always came in later than they should have, which meant we had a horrendous tripling problem.
That's right.
Students tripling on this campus is till this day, even though the issue is so much smaller now, has always believed that tripling was the symbol of the incompetence of everybody and certainly a sacrilege in terms of one's personal comfort. There's an element of truth to that. So we moved into the dorms as quickly as we could. As soon as they were safe, never mind well furnished, but safe, we moved in. And they were often just barely completed, and usually a number of things, in fact, didn't work. So we moved in too early in that sense, but always about 6 months later than the university had designed their occupancy for. So the students, if you look at the issue of student destructiveness, we set the stage unintentionally by moving people into incomplete dorms too early, even though we had tripled them for a whole semester before they could then move into these new dorms. And they took an awful pounding. So the, you know,
the dorms did.
The dorms took an awful pounding. Yep. And indeed, they are still in awful shape. And if you hunt around in many of them, you can still see a lot of the scars from the 60s. Mm-hmm. For years, the faculty have been blaming the students of their current year-to-year group for destroying the dorms, when in fact, the major destruction was done 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we have never been able to convince...